to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us today, Bill?
Well, we have a sponsor, one of a few sponsors here, Pape Machinery. They are our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard up in the city of Shasta Lake. Go up and see them. Got a great inventory right now of brand new John Deere tractors, mowers, implements, you name it. Go up and see them. If they don't have it, they can get it to you in short order. They also have full parts and service that can fix up what you're working on. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and the word in, I know you're all going to be shocked, but the word from the control booth here is that Ambassador Rooney is missing in action.
Oh, no.
Ruh-roh.
No, he's back with us.
Oh, he's back.
Oh, he's back.
I thought we were going to have that thing we had a couple weeks ago.
Where not the
like,
thing.
Oh, no.
Ronnie's here. He's on the line with us.
Nice, Ambassador Rooney.
How are you?
He gave me a little. A couple of weeks ago, we called this lady she was going to be on, and it turned out she had a surgery on Friday, and by Sunday, she had to go to the emergency room, so at 11:30, she went to the emergency room, forgot about us, and we were like, hello?
Can you imagine calling that? Going to an emergency room over us, I don't understand.
And she
that.
Didn't call.
Yeah.
No.
We weren't on her emergency contact list, so anyway, now I'm worried. Now if they don't answer on the first ring, it's like, oh no, it's happening again.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, having been in politics, I'm careful about answering phones where names don't come up.
Oh yeah.
That's a problem.
I had a phone call last night. We'll just leave that go because it was, you know, I got to say, this has been a very strange week, and I haven't found anybody that hasn't had a bunch of crazy phone calls or a bunch of really bizarre interactions. I'm not sure. Maybe we should have had some sort of psychic or astrological genius on who could have decoded that for us, because there's obviously something weird going around. Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, well,
for those people who haven't caught previous shows with you, you're obviously an American, and now you're you were a politician, and you already confessed that, and a diplomat. So you've done a bunch of different things. You represented Florida's 19th congressional district in the Republican caucus, served as United States ambassador to the Holy See, a.k.a. the Vatican, for those who don't speak Vatican, under George W. Bush from 2005 to 2008. And I don't know, are you still the chairman of Rooney Holdings? It's got your name on it, but...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Have you, I was going to say, have you abdicated the throne and had your children run it or anything? No.
Well, we have our children running many of our businesses, and it's great. My wife and I get to work with them.
That's
and
fun.
Mentor them, and they get to grow and make their own decisions, and it's great to see.
That's awesome.
That's great. Yeah.
And one of the things we've posted on the site for today, by the way, it is January 28th, 2024, the time we're airing this live, and your book is called The Global Vatican. And
yes.
I have links and info on there from that, and it's really super, super interesting. The little tagline here, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. Is that, just out of curiosity, back to your former connection, is that still possible? It seems like things are a little weird right now with Pope Francis.
Well, this Pope is different than the one that... was Pope when I was up there.
Yeah.
That I worked with. Pope Benedict, the German Pope, was a very doctrinaire, by the book Pope, who was very focused on the dogma of the Church and on the Holy See's ability to influence world events in a more of a diplomatic and strategic way. This new guy, he's a little more of a liberation theologist, if you will,
mm-hmm.
a little more focused on the developing world versus the developed world and that conflict that comes out of liberation theology. And that I think that makes him less effective diplomatically. And then, of course, he comes out and says, that we are to blame for Putin's insecurity because we expanded NATO. And I wrote an op-ed about that. That's totally ridiculous.
Yeah,
he's always kind of pushing the kind of the commie marching orders.
Well, it's not the first thing he's said that's
frustrated
been
about
fairly
it.
Controversial.
He wrote that encyclopedia about the environment, Laudato Si. And he didn't mention one word about these sorry African countries that are totally corrupt.
No.
He only talked about the developed world not paying enough money to those African countries so that they will not pollute.
And, it's just, it's kind of like, gosh, with him, it's sort of like stay in your lane. Would it be, so if you were teleported into your previous job and you had to be the ambassador right now, how does that work? Do they ask you things, or do you just have to sit and listen, or do you get to say, hey, you know what, this isn't actually helpful?
Well, when you're there, you've got to be careful.
Right.
But you can criticize them and protect the United States. So when he does something that's inimical to the interests of the United States, you got to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I wasn't sure how much piping
absolutely.
Up you get to do.
Just like any other secular mission. I mean, when France does something that we don't like, the ambassador better go there and speak up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much of it was, you were sort of trapped in the nice bubble.
The job's to protect U.S. interests.
So bottom line is, if we have an ambassador who isn't doing that, it isn't because they can't, it's because they're not doing that.
That's right. The job is to protect the United States' interests, period. Diplomatically, practically, dealing with foreign visitors that have business with the Holy See, that come from the United States, that we could help. All those things that go into leveraging the relationship for the benefit of our country.
Well, that's, I guess, what most of us would think they were doing, but then some of them, you look at it and you go, are they playing for the wrong team? Or are there some kind of weird rules we don't know about? But, I bet that was a really, like as a kid, you probably never thought, gee, I think I'm going to grow up and be an ambassador to the Vatican. It's probably not on your list of things to do. Talk to us.
Well, it was a great opportunity for me and my family, both to live in Rome and to be at the seat of the church, but also to work so closely with a Pope that really cared about the United States and a president that really cared what the Holy See could do in the world.
Yeah, well, because they do have a lot of reach if they use it.
Yeah. Well, you read my book. You'll see a lot of instances of things where we work with the Holy See and they did some things that we couldn't do ourselves. They did it for us.
Right, right. No, I know. You do a great job of detailing all that. I think it's kind of awesome to have that kind of behind-the-scenes look, I think, for people who may not consider, we don't hear so much from our ambassadors all the time just out in the mainstream, unless it's something that you particularly follow or something bad happens. You provide a really invaluable look at that. Today you had been contacted by our favorite friend, Stephen Manfredi, and he said, hey, how about you have the ambassador on? And he'd like to speak about Israel and the Hamas war. And it's like, oh, nobody even knows what's going on there. Everybody's fixated on it. So, but I thought you would have a really kind of an interesting vantage point on that.
Well, I mean, I think, look, you shouldn't speak about the Middle East if you haven't read the latter half of the Quran. The latter half of the Quran, after Mohammed became comfortable, confident, and successful, becomes aggressive. And that's where all that nefarious language about spread the word by the sword and take out the infidel, that's where all that stuff creeps in.
Mm-hmm.
And people should read that. And understand that is really part of their Bible. And when they get up and jump up and down about jihad and all that, that's the stuff they're reading from.
Right. The idea that it's this... We've done so many shows on Islam, and anybody who still thinks it's the religion of peace really needs to go back and listen. There's an entire undercurrent, and has always been, about domination and subjugation and all of that.
Oh, it's a very warlike religion.
Mm-hmm.
At least the last half of the Quran, after Muhammad became successful and decided to take over the world, or whatever part of the world he could get.
Yeah. Well, he had a... there's a really cool book called It's All About Muhammad. Like, the book is all about Muhammad, but the book is called It's All About Muhammad. And basically, it's a biography of Muhammad from when he was a small boy.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, you can't put it down. You read that book, and it's a page.
I'll check it out.
Yeah,
it's an eye opener.
And it's all backed up with sources. I mean, the back part of the book will give you
pages and pages of sources.
Yeah. So it's not somebody's opinion. It's facts.
Yeah, it's really well researched. But yeah, once you start looking into that, you realize. I mean, he kind of started. He was kind of like a pirate, you know, pillage, get stuff, build his group, a bigger group. Let's go over and pillage those guys, take their stuff. Hey, you want to go pillage those guys? And it's kind of like reading the life of Jesus in like backwards.
Well, he really didn't do anything that the secular leaders of their time didn't do. Alexander the Great, the Seljuk Turks, etc. But just he hit it in the guise of a religion.
Yeah. And to pretend that they're all going to live together and it's all going to be peaceful.
Well, they do, as long as as the infidels do what they tell them to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as they pay and do what they're told. Otherwise, off with their heads.
So are you...
Right.
I don't know, surprised is probably the wrong word. I'm not sure any of us are technically surprised, but with the amount of support that the whole Hamas team, I mean, I don't know what you call it. It's a side, I suppose. But in this country, the people are supporting that and the absolute hate on Israel.
I am more than surprised. I'm shocked. And I think it exposes a material defect, debility, cancer in our country that this younger generation and all these college professors could get away with saying the things they're saying against the enemies of our life, our faith, and our country.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've been saying it for a long time.
They need to be held accountable for what they're saying.
Yep.
Yeah, I and there are people that are not young. I mean, when I was in college, I don't remember, it would have been in the 70s, early 80s, I don't remember anybody talking about any of that stuff, really at all. It was post-Vietnam.
No, the Islamic world really didn't exist back then. It started about the time of the Arab oil boycott in 73.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of started leaning that way? So what would you...
Well, people became aware that they existed.
What would you say to the people who say, well, you know, we shouldn't be defending Israel, that they, you know, that befriend, you know, being a, oh, I don't know what they, I forget the verbiage they use, but, you know, being Team Israel is bad, and it's bad for our country.
Well, first of all, I would say that the Jews were in Samaria and Judea right after Moses, so they've been there a long time. You can't really say they're interlopers. And there's a lot of land over there, and the Palestinians and the Jews have never quite got along all that great. But I'm not sure that that's the fault of the Israelis or the Jews. Palestinians were murdering Jews before there was an Israel. And it goes back to that religion, you know,
yep.
The infidel.
Yep. It never
ended. They became an Israel, and they had a different excuse to try to come after them. And Israel's trying to defend itself. And remember, Hamas invaded them.
Right.
They didn't go over there and attack Hamas. Hamas invaded them and killed 1,400 people.
Yeah, and for them now, I mean, to say, oh, they've gone too far. They need to stop. Well, I don't think they can stop. They have to put an end to this. Otherwise, it's just going to happen again, isn't it?
Yeah, it will. And if you don't cut the head off the snake. And first and second of all, you know, we saw this in the Lebanon War in 2007. The Hamas and or Hezbollah uses human shields. They maximize civilian casualties because they do not value life. And that makes it harder for our liberals to accept. And we need to look beyond the deaths and say, wait, who's causing them really? I think the Palestinians are causing them. Hamas is causing them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just think it's so difficult to say that, to just look at that whole thing and hear everybody's just going about their lives. These guys come and attack them and they're the good guys. It's like, wait, that's, I can't think of an instance where that has been the, you know what I mean?
Well, like, I think it's exposing some really defective philosophy among the generation that began shortly before 2000. The recent one most inculcated with the radicalism of college professors. And some of the stuff that we're seeing about this settler colonialism and how Palestinians are just like Indians and Indians are just like blacks and else that has a beef with the people. I mean, it's like it's a very insidious mantra because it can be expanded to anybody that's got a beef. If I have a beef, I'm saying, oh yeah, I'm colonized.
You're a colonizer.
And exposed. Yeah, right.
You know what? When we come back, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, can you peel that apart in a little bit more detail and maybe give people better information on that? Because honestly, you know it's crazy, but I'm not sure a lot of people have a good argument for that. So maybe you could help them with their argument. How's that?
Sure.
To win the argument. We'll be right back. Our guest is Ambassador Francis Rooney. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Chain reaction, strange attraction. I guess that's that was a good lead in for this. I didn't really think about that. But Ambassador, it makes no sense, you know, when people want to say that the Israelis are colonizers and all that. I mean, for heaven's sakes, I'm not sure we're all that great with geography, but for the people that are unclear about the size of Israel, Israel can fit in the state of California 8 times. It's not a big place. And to think that these guys can roll in and bomb them and all that, and the people in the tiny country living their lives who really pretty much get along with almost everybody, they have a little bit of everybody in their country, and they're really, I don't know, they all seem pretty happy for the most part. Uh-oh, is he on mute? Is he trapped?
You got to remember a couple of things,
there he is.
Okay?
You're back.
First of all, towards the end of Bill Clinton's term, a couple of guys from the CIA who are friends of mine, and Ehud Barak, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Yasser Arafat met. And the Ehud Barak wrote down all the things that Yasser Arafat had asked for. And Arafat walked out of the room. He didn't want peace. He needs a pinata to flog so he can get more money. He didn't care about his country.
Mm-hmm.
And then, later, the same thing happened with Olmert, with Abbas, where Olmert offered Abbas pretty much everything they were asking for, maybe one or two things not, but mostly, and Abbas walked out. These guys, the conundrum of Palestine is, everybody would like them to have a state. The two-state solution is probably the only long-term, but it's an idealistic notion right now. We have to work towards it, but we've got to come up with a way to find some Palestinians or other Arabs that can operate a country. You know, like get the trash picked up, make the electricity and water work, have police, kill off bad guys, the whole bit. And we haven't been able to find the secret sauce on that yet.
Yeah. That, and just based on your experience over there, do you think they exist?
Someday I'm optimistic that they will. I mean, there have been a lot of other countries evolve to get to a better place. But these guys haven't been able to figure it out yet.
Yeah.
Nor have a lot of other countries in the Middle East, like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Do you think the two-state solution is kind of a pipe dream, or do you think that'll ever happen?
I think it's an aspirational goal that we have to work towards.
Even if they
How can you say to the Palestinians, there's no hope for you to have a state?
Right.
But let's say they did create them a state, like just based on everything we've been watching over the years, I'm not really sure that would... I'm not sure they'd be happy with that. You know what I mean?
Well, they were happy with the idea of Hamas coming in and offering promise of running a good country. You know, like I said, like a mayor, get
right.
the trash picked up, make the electricity work, etc. Not all this big fancy policy, because the PA was so corrupt. And then come in Hamas, and they turned into a terrorist organization, which really no better or maybe even worse than the PA.
Right. So they've got to really look at their own leadership and come up
they do.
With
solution. And that's why I say, you know, they should be held accountable for their people.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone will say all this bad stuff about Israel and all that, but why don't we say, Palestinians, take responsibility for your life?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
Which I would say the same thing to the college kids that we're seeing protesting about Israel right now. You better take responsibility for your life, not theirs.
Yeah. I don't... It's never a dialogue. It's always, we're going to beat you into submission, and if you don't submit, we're just going to get louder and more violent, and then we're going to make you agree with us. And it's like, I'm not really sure that's a winning strategy.
Well, it doesn't hurt when the impartial arbiters, the people in charge, like the university presidents and whatnot, can't figure out how to say exactly that. You can protest, you have rights, but other people have rights too. And we're an impartial arbiter of everybody's opportunity to express themselves under the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
These college professors and college presidents don't seem to be able to do that.
Well, they don't seem to be able to teach, you know, real history. I mean, if you go back and look at the history, I think a lot of these kids wouldn't be quite so confused about who they're cheering for. It's just nuts to think that current state of Palestine or the West Bank or whatever is gonna, you know, lay down their weapons and agree or get along. I mean, I think, you know, they've been fighting for so long. They really need a change of attitudes and leadership to kind of open the dialogue.
I blame professors and college administrators for that, mm-hmm. by not allowing the free and full expression of all sides and
right.
trying to repress any voice that they disagree with.
And why
that's totalitarianism in itself.
Why do you think that is? That they want to go just with a one-sided philosophy?
Now, I think they've become intellectually degraded by their and overwhelmed by their, or consumed, I should say, consumed by their desire to accomplish certain woke objectives in terms of education and the kind of things people think, the radical views and the suppression of any kind of conservative opposing thought. And that creates a very bad climate.
Right. Well, they've been doing it for so long, and they've been doing it with the support of a lot of folks, a lot of the media. I mean, so much of this has just gone unchecked for so long, and now
yeah.
we're starting to see the result of this.
But at least a lot of big donors and alumni are starting to speak up now and saying, wait a minute.
Yes.
You've been doing all this garbage under our nose, and we're not going to stand for it.
Yeah.
Right.
So when they come at you with their colonizers, what's your... You know, I mean, if you actually were able to make a reasonable argument.
You have to contextualize life. I mean, you have to contextualize how the Egyptians treated the Israelites, how Genghis Khan treated the people he conquered, how the world evolved in the Middle Ages with serfs and villains and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And those were tough times, and a lot of people were killed for very mm-hmm. minor offenses. If you made your lord mad, he'd cut your head off.
Right.
So this is nothing new in the evolution of history. So then you move into modern times, and you have, you know, totalitarian regimes like Hitler and Marxism, and they preyed on people's weakness and got control of their country, and people couldn't speak up. And that's why our First Amendment and our Constitution is a bulwark against that happening now. And so when these college professors and DAs and stuff like that are willing to pursue a philosophy of the end justifies the means, then we've forsaken the constitutional protections, and we're just like no different than communism.
Right.
We're just going for the result we want.
Yeah, and we'll browbeat you until we get it. And if we have to, we'll lie.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this
but
is...
But I think there's a bit of a pushback now. I'm seeing in some incipient pushbacks, and I'm really hopeful it develops.
The tough part is when you kind of get into the... you know, out into society, and you have these, you know, you have these groups that feel so empowered that they can go bully somebody in the street or at their home, or and it's like, where in American life has that ever been acceptable? I mean, it's been done,
yeah, well,
but it hasn't been acceptable.
This whole liberal thing of getting rid of the police, no cash bail, and you know, in California, you can steal up to $900 and they won't prosecute you. You know, I saw some article where there was one guy in some California town that had hit the same Walmart or Costco like 10, 15 times, and he always steals less than $900 and they can't pick him up.
Yeah.
So you look at that kind of stuff, and how degrading is that to our culture and values of society that people get away with that? In D.C. right now, we have 14- and 15-year-olds being used as mules by the gangs to hijack cars. Because they know that if you pick a kid up, they're going to let him out.
Yeah, I think I've told this before, but I went into a store here in town, and the girl looked a little, it's a small place, and she looked a little freaked out, and I said, you know, are you okay? And she said, we just got robbed. And I'm like, what? Do you need to call somebody? She's like, I don't think they'll do anything. They're gone. And I never saw anybody going in or out, but it's in a shopping center. And she said there were four of them that came in. One had a calculator, and the other three ran around the place and took stuff, shouting out the prices. And as soon as they hit the...
So they could stay under the felony limit.
Yep. As soon as they hit 950, they just ran right out the door. And I thought, got to be kidding me.
It's nuts. But I do think there's a bit of a backlash on some of that now.
Yeah, people are getting tired of it.
There's still a lot more sane people than there are spoiled kids and criminals.
True. Well, when... like, on the history of Israel as a country, like, maybe you could... give people a little short overview kind of on the whole West Bank and all that whole thing, because that's kind of that's one they exploit a lot because people are kind of uninformed about that.
Well, if you go over there and you see how small it is, you can appreciate Israel's interest in having the West Bank, because the original territory of Israel is very small.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Jerusalem is partitioned among all the different sects. The question is, what should the Palestinians have? And there are Palestinians that live quite comfortably in the West Bank. They have farms and they have jobs. And then there's this problem of Gaza, where nobody's been able to create a state there that would be functional. And I don't think you can blame Israel for that. That's been all Palestinians. It's been their sandbox,
mm-hmm.
literally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think at some point they have to take responsibility for what they have and say, hey, look, this isn't working for us. We could have it much better. Let's make some changes. But I don't know. They don't seem to be able to see that. They don't seem to be able to...
No, they seem to go for the same victimhood that you see some of these movements in the United States. Everybody's a victim of some colonizer.
Right.
Yeah, the hard and the hard part with that too is, I mean, when you're raising your children to hate the people who basically live next door, the outcome of that is always going to be bad.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. There's like a million jokes, you know. So is that meme that circulates around during this whole thing? It's a big white room, a giant white room actually, and there's nothing in it. There's some guy standing in there, and it's captioned a Palestinian Museum of History.
Yeah.
Because I mean, honestly, what have they done in history? What contribution have they made?
Yeah, they've always been the non-Jewish tribal people going back to the Bible. You know, they were there in Judea and Samaria, and then the Jews were there too. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't all this hegemony; they were just all there. And I don't recall there was a lot of conflict. I mean, you had the Good Samaritan, you know, that kind of thing. I think a lot of this geopolitics and conflict has arisen by the development of a successful Israeli state and the inability of the Palestinians to provide something for themselves.
Right. Well, see, that's part of what I don't really understand is Israel had, when they became a state, they had nothing. I mean, they started from scratch just like everybody else over there. And they've been able to produce a society that's successful and you know, has...
Gosh, they've made a zillion innovations.
Yeah, I mean but their geography and resources are no different than their neighbors to speak of. Some of their neighbors are much better off resource-wise than Israel, but they don't seem to be able to develop a society that is successful and able to build and grow and
they take everything that they have, all their resources get stripped down and used to make tunnels so they can kill their neighbors.
Well, and weapons they seem to be focused on warring rather than growing a successful society, and it doesn't seem like it's that hard to identify that you're kind of on the wrong path here. It's if we change directions, maybe we can have some of what our neighbors have.
Well, that gets back to finding some Palestinians or Arabs that are willing to not be corrupt and to build a country for their future people and not take it all for themselves. And that hasn't happened yet over there.
And you think that's the corruption part of it has been part of their society for forever?
Well, yeah, there's a pretty embedded corruption ethic there. Mm-hmm. But it's more than that. It's the inability of any Palestinian yet to forego theft and build a country. I mean, there's no Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, Hamilton over there that says, I'm going to put the country ahead of me. That hasn't happened yet.
Right.
It's happened in Israel, for sure, but not there.
Yeah, and I think that's really what it's going to take for other people to look at it and go, hey, you know what, this seems to be working out. Let's go down this road. But I don't know, as long as, you know, there's been time, they've never been able to figure that part out.
That's never been the focus.
The Israelis have tried. You know, companies like Elbit Industries and stuff have gone over to Gaza plants and hired the locals and trained them and tried to give them make where they could have productive incomes. You know, they've tried, but
yeah, it's not like
it hasn't been scaled up.
Yeah, it's not like nobody ever gave them a break. I mean, people have gone over there and tried to build business and try to make things work, but it always seems to fall back on the same ideology.
We hate you. Yeah. We must kill you.
We need more rockets.
We can't move forward because you're bad.
Well, see, and that goes back to Arafat and Abbas not wanting to cut a deal. They don't really want a deal. They want a pinata to swat
right
at.
Right. Yeah, that's
which is,
and when the pinata is much bigger and stronger than you, that's really not a good plan. because it's what's going to happen is what's happening right now is they're going to hit back, and they're not going to hit back once. They're going
to. I'm curious. We have to take a quick break again, but when we, I'm curious if you were if you were on the hot seat for a prediction where you think maybe this goes in the short run. You know, maybe not 100 years from now, but maybe in the short run. Do we solve it? Do we just fight forever? I'm kind of curious what you think based on your experience. We'll be right back. Our guest is Ambassador Francis Rooney. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. Out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch, but it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much. Does that make me crazy? Does that make me crazy? Does that make me crazy?
Yeah, I'm sure they're working on that technology as we speak.
Nice.
You shoot you down with the angry eyes, you know. Loggins and Messina figured that out a long time ago. So where do you think this is gonna go? I mean,
is anything changed, or will anything change as a result of?
Because people are getting kind of pissed off about the aid. That's the whole thing, you know. Hey, we need to stop helping them. I don't know. What do you think? Whoops. I think he's...
Yeah, I don't think anybody's concerned about that. I mean, I think our country's focused on helping Israel.
Oh, no, there's a huge pushback on the aid.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this gets you back to your college students and your professors and things like that. No, I think the American people seem to be pretty far solidly behind letting Israel defend itself.
Yeah.
If that changes, we are really in trouble.
Yeah, because there's a lot of pressure on the members of Congress to reel in the aid. You know, well, hey, how long are we going to help these guys? How long is this going to go on? And I'm kind of surprised at where... that's originating, because it isn't the college students or the professors. These are just rank and file regular people, and they're looking at the board. What they're doing is, I guess, conflating isn't really the right word, but they are with the border. You know, we can't fix our own border. Why are we helping all these foreign countries?
Like, well, we can fix our border. We just got to have political will to do it.
Right. I mean, like if we didn't spend the money on Israel, that would fix the border somehow, which isn't a thing. But
no, the two aren't related at all.
No, they're not.
Fixing the border is a very simple proposition of stopping people from claiming asylum if they're already here, limiting asylum claims, don't have this parole thing, this program of the president to let anybody in he wants, which has gotten to be 1.5 million people this year.
Yeah.
Stop all that garbage and secure the border. And we can use technology to do that.
Well, we've done
it. We can put enough drones and stuff up there to see anything that's moving, from a jackrabbit to a missile.
Well, we're not making any effort. We're helping them come in and then letting them go to wherever they want. But I guess
that seems
I'm just
to be what some of the government wants.
Yeah, they obviously want it, otherwise it wouldn't be happening. But I worry that things like this conflict in Israel get caught in the crossfire because people are so up in arms about that sort of thing. And I don't think they really separate those. It's almost like if we weren't helping Israel,
Ukraine,
we could close the border. And it's like, well, that's not actually it. That's not.
But isn't that the syllogism that they're deploying now about Ukraine?
Yes,
the,
and
the
I was
hardcore
just,
conservatives are saying, you know, if you want Ukraine money, you got to deal with this.
Yes, and I was going to say that's really that's kind of part and parcel, same thing. We could close.
And they're two different issues.
Yeah, I do see using it as leverage. I mean, they are trying to use it as leverage to force the Biden administration to deal with the border. I mean, that makes sense. I haven't heard really anybody make the. Well, okay. It probably has been done, but I hear it more from the public than I do from members in Congress that if we weren't spending money on Ukraine, then it would be we could close the border. I hear that from people.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And that's not really.
It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you know the good thing about all that? It's gone broader than that now. Now people are just saying, Democrats and Republicans, secure the border. Not
right.
worrying about Ukraine or anybody else. Secure the border. And that's why Biden, this feckless leader, has come out and said, oh, yeah, we'll just secure the border. Well, when did he wake up and figure that out?
Right.
Because the people are telling him that. His people are telling him that. His Democrats are telling him that.
Yeah, I just hope they get louder because, you know, the crazy part is everybody's like, well, we need comprehensive immigration reform. It's like, well, I know. I have an idea. Let's follow the laws we actually have and see if it works.
Yeah.
Like, let's just see what happens.
Well,
we
never had any problem. Go back. We were always able to secure our border. Our border was, it wasn't perfect. And people did sneak in,
but we didn't have millions of people.
Not
that we
millions of people a year. This constant flow and these caravans.
Look, social media has changed the game, and the ability of people to get to Mexico and to get themselves up near our border is so much different now than it was 5 years ago. And we need to be on top of our game to figure out how to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And once they get here, to repel them rather than bring them in, give them money and bus tickets.
I mean, what George Bush tried to do in 2007 was close the border and set up a procedure for people to come get work permits. And you had to apply
right.
and be checked out and vetted. And if everything looked out good for you, you could come in and get yourself a job. And we do need the workers badly. But we need the people that are not criminals. That we understand who they are, we know where they are, we know about their family. We need to know about them, just like any citizen, you know?
Well, when you look at the, like you were saying, the million plus people who have come across the border this year, how many of those are workers? I mean, I see, people are lining the streets looking for handouts once they get over here. They're not working.
That's another issue. The federal judges have expanded the rights of illegals in some incredible areas. Like in California, they can vote. They have the right to go to an emergency room. They have the right to get certain government benefits. I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah. Well, they're overwhelming. They're totally overwhelming the system, and I think that's the plan, is to overwhelm the system. And you look at our school systems, you look at our healthcare systems, they're being overwhelmed with illegal aliens. I think you can still call them that. I just don't see enough being done to curb that, and the only way to do it is to close the border, and it just can't be that tough.
Well, we're helping other countries.
That is the only way, because, you know, I mean, I feel sorry for people that come from these crummy countries.
Oh, yeah.
But our responsibility is really to our country.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And now we do need workers. So there needs to us, if we're going to pursue our national interest, we pursue our national interest to get the kind of people in here that can do a job and add value to our economy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel, you know, if I was a citizen of one of those countries and there was a free pass to the United States, I'd be in the next caravan too. I mean, there's no system in place right now to stop people from just saying, "Hey, I want to come. I want to take advantage of the United States. If they're going to let me in, I'm coming." That's got to stop. And it's just not that hard to close the border. We have the resources.
It's politically hard, but practically easy.
Exactly.
I think that's where people freak out about both Ukraine and Israel. It's like we're helping them maintain the sovereignty of their country while ours is...
Yeah, the focus. Yeah, exactly.
Ours is being tossed.
Well, there is no focus.
Although I think we could do all those things at the same time. So with the Israeli situation, do you see the Hamas guys ever, well, because now they've got all the support of all the countries around them, you see them ever like just, okay, I guess we're done, we'll stop attacking them? Like, how do you see that ending?
He's right. They're going to have to kill off all the Hamas leadership.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then maybe, if they're in enough disarray, then possibly we can draw the leading Arab states into some kind of coalition to save Gaza. Because at the end of the day, they're the people that are there. They're the people that have the same religion. They need to take the front end of how to deal with Gaza instead of having the United States or Israel do it.
Right. Yeah, because that's always going to be a fight. That's always going to be, you don't belong here, so why will we listen to you? You're right.
Just let the moderate Arabs do it. They have the resources.
Right.
The problem is getting them to get their fingers under the rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who do you see as being, just kind of based on your history in that part of the world, do you see anybody there being sensible?
Well, to make anything serious work, among the Arab countries, you've got to have Saudi Arabia. They're the 900-pound gorilla.
Okay.
If you don't have MBS, then there's going to be limited participation by Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, etc. They are the big country. They have the big economy. And if they would take the leadership, they may be able to come up with a provisional governing body that could support some kind of government in Gaza that would be able to be held accountable.
Well, do you think, you know, there's a will on Saudi Arabia's part to take leadership and lead that coalition? Because I don't see them working with everybody. Do you think they would be willing to do that?
I think that Anthony Blinken and the State Department guys have spent a lot of time lately in the Middle East talking about that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well...
Are there any of them in this administration, like when you say Anthony Blinken, I just want to bash my head against the table. Are there any of them that you think, because Kirby and all those guys, it just seemed to, I don't know, I can't say anything I want to say on the radio.
Anthony Blinken is a career State Department Foreign Service officer with a very distinguished career. Now, by definition, they're not going to get above their skis, and they're responding to the political authorities that they report to.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear Blinken say something, you need to spell the word Biden.
Right. Right.
It's not his fault.
He's the mouthpiece.
He is the Secretary of State executing the policy of the White House.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where it's got to change. It's got to start right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you see if Trump gets back in office? What do you see happening there?
You know, there's a lot of things about Trump that I fear. A lot of things that he says. A lot of things that he did last time that were disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope that he will not go back to this Abraham Accord thing. And continue to back whoever he picks as state, if he does win, first of all, whoever he picks as Secretary of State continues to develop the aspirational two-state solution and work to draw the Arab countries in to an intermediate governance structure that will provide the kind of guidance that the whatever leaders they can find for Gaza need.
Yeah, we just need to hope he has the foresight to
fingers
do
crossed.
Like that.
All right, we'll chat again. Ambassador, we are out of time and got to jump off here. Thank you so much for being on with us. We have Phil Kirpin coming up next hour, and we're going to talk about Wi-Fi and stuff like that. So we're going to switch gears.
Switch gears, yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Ambassador.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and they've got everything you can imagine when it comes to John Deere. They've got tractors and loaders and mowers and you name it. Go up and see them. They can get you set up. They got great financing right now. They're running some 0% programs that...
that no one's doing.
Yeah, nobody's going 0%, but John Deere is. Go up and see them. You can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Chat with them about what's available right now and what kind of a deal they can make you. They're also a new dealer for Ego lawn equipment, which is all battery-operated. So they're going to have battery-operated riding mowers and handheld equipment. Thank you, California, because that's going to be pretty much all you're going to get if it's under 25 horsepower now. You're going to go electric. And it's going to be good.
Whether you want it or not.
It'll be good for you, yeah. So go up and see them. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Free advertisement of the week goes to the Hilltop Diner. By the way, I forgot to do it the first hour. Hilltop Diner is awesome. So if you live in Reading, I realize a lot of our listeners do not, but if you do, it's in the old Marie Callender's building there at Mistletoe and Hilltop across from the Holiday Inn. And, okay, they have these things. They're called Texas Toothpicks. It's kind of listed as, like, you can have tater tots, fries, coleslaw, blah, 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 Texas Toothpicks. And you're thinking, oh, they're just like skinny French fries. Yeah, no, they're not. They are onions and jalapenos.
Yeah.
Deep fried, like little sticks.
Burn anyway, your face off.
No, they don't burn your face off. They're fantastic.
Yeah, I don't.
And they don't burn your face off. Bill's never had one. Yeah. Full disclosure, Bill has never put one in his mouth. No, he has no idea.
I look at them and they look like jalapenos, and jalapenos
they're just
burn
green.
Your face off.
He has no idea what it would do to his face. God. I'm going to lie about my free thing of the week anyway, so Hilltop Diner. And plus, whatever you ask him to do different, you know, if you want extra stuff added, okay, because that's me. I never see something on the menu. I like the way it is. I always change it. And they do such a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't give you the old, like, yeah, okay, here you go. Here's your messed up thing that we didn't have on our list.
Yeah, Aaron's a big gravy fan, so.
Yeah. Hard pass. Hard pass.
Hard pass on the gravy.
I told my server the other day, I'm like, no, gravy, we're just going to call it Yucky. We're going to change its name. It's just going to be called Yucky from here on.
And he agreed not to put any Yucky on your dinner.
I know. God bless him. Okay. Sorry, Phil.
That's
no,
all right.
No, I made it weird.
I would try those.
Oh, my God. They're so great. They really are super great. It's kind of like the Bloomin' Onion thing they do at TGI Fridays or somewhere.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Somewhere does that. And they kind of like deep fry an onion with all the little sticks sticking up. It's like if you sawed all the little sticks off and then made a bunch of jalapenos with it. They're fantastic. And I didn't order them for the longest time because I didn't know what they were. My bad. So anyway, our guest this hour, we're going to switch gears.
Yeah, let's circle back around here.
We're going to talk about the opposition to the FCC regulations of the Internet. Yay! Because we care about that. And a lot of times, you know, they come at us with these regulations and that turns into a big mess.
Everybody loves more regulation.
Yeah. Because it usually makes our lives so much better.
Yeah.
Phil Kirpin is a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington. He was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. Previously worked at the Free Enterprise Fund, Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. He's a nationally syndicated columnist, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, and author of the 2011 book, Democracy Denied. He's the president of American Commitment, which is dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom.
What's not to like?
How in the heck could you go wrong with a list like that?
That's right.
All right, Phil, what kind of nuttiness are they doing to the Internet, or do they want to do to the Internet?
Well, it's pretty amazing, actually. I think this is
a good example
of the left's total imperviousness to reality and imperviousness to facts. You might remember about 6 or 7 years ago when the Trump FCC said they were going to repeal the Obama net neutrality regulations, which had only been in place for 2 years at that point. The Democrats and the media acted like this was the end of the universe. I mean,
right.
They were literally predicting mass death. They said, oh, the Internet will break, people won't get suicide prevention resources, and there's going to be a mass die-off.
Oh, I missed that one.
As a result of this deregulation, and the Internet's going to load one word at a time, and it's going to be a vast wasteland, and everything's going to be, it's going to be a disaster. I mean, basically every liberal publication had a headline to that effect. Every Democratic politician had a quote to that effect. And, you know, the Trump FCC went ahead and did it anyway, repealed it anyway, and there were no follow-up stories.
Yeah.
Because
I didn't notice any difference.
Of those, yeah, zero of the, well, there actually was a difference, but it was a positive difference. This is what happened. So private investment went back up to the pre-regulation trend line, increased pretty dramatically. Average Internet speeds approximately tripled in just a couple of years after deregulation. And prices were actually down a little bit. They're up a little bit now, although much less than inflation. But for a couple of years, they were actually down, the amount that people paid. So, you know, if there's ever been an example of a deregulation doing exactly what you wanted it to do, it would be this, right? You got more investment, you got better service at a lower cost. They're basically everything you could want from a deregulation. And yet, the Democrats come in, and as soon as they got a third Democrat on the FCC, which took them a few years because they tried to put a real left-wing nut job who got rejected even by Democratic senators a few times. So they didn't actually get a majority until about a year ago. And, you know, what was the first thing they did? They said, we're going to bring back the Obama net neutrality regulations and more, actually, because now they no longer are happy with economic regulation. Now they also have to have equity regulation, and so they have a companion order.
They do.
They had one order to bring back the Obama regulation, and they had another one for what they call digital discrimination, and now they're going to prohibit any business practice that has a disparate impact on any of the laundry list of protected classes, sex, race, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're going to be the economic regulators of Internet providers, and they're also going to be the equity police for the Internet, and you know, it's pretty easy to predict what's going to happen. We're going to get less private investment because, you don't know what the bureaucrats are going to let you do or not do. And they actually kind of admit this. In the new net neutrality order, they kind of admit they're going to get less private investment because they have a paragraph in there that kind of says, you know, critics say we're going to get less private investment if we regulate, but that doesn't matter because we have all this tax money. We've got, you know, $65 billion from the infrastructure bill, and, you know, there's so much government money now that we don't need private investment. So this is the path they want to go down, essentially, is more and more tax dollars, more and more regulations to disincentivize private investment. And what's really so insane about the timing of this happening now is we just had kind of the ultimate test of whether a deregulated model or a regulated model is better for Internet service, which is when the lockdowns happened. When the lockdowns happened, you know, Internet traffic demand went up something like 40% overnight globally. In the U.S., we basically handled it fine. I mean, you might have had a call that dropped now and then or something like that, but basically we handled it fine. We had no bandwidth constraints of any significance in the U.S. In Europe, they had a total crisis. The regulators actually had to call YouTube, call Netflix, say, throttle back your streams or the network's going to break. We had nothing like that in the U.S., and so the regulated model failed when there was a big surge in demand. The deregulated model succeeded. And yet our current FCC chair, when she announced she was bringing back these regulations, actually gave a speech about how, you know, I had bad Wi-Fi in my house during COVID, and that's when I knew we had to regulate the Internet. And I'm watching this, and I'm just like, can I buy her a new router? And
the rest of the
this is like the craziest thing I've ever seen. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so they've now finalized these regulations. They're going to come back into effect. They finalized the digital discrimination one. It's going to come back into effect. Obviously, there'll be litigation. There always is. Maybe the courts will do something about it. Maybe President Trump will come back in and repeal it again, and they'll predict that we're all going to die all over again. But I just think it's an incredible illustration of how liberals will not be dissuaded from their attempts to regulate everything by reality, by the experience being the opposite of what they said it would be.
Well, I think that they don't want to go too far on this, but my guess is they want to, quote, regulate it so that they can control what we say, so that they can decide that we're doing...
Well, be careful. I've said that, and whenever I say that, I get called a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
But I do agree with you.
But, they never
control content.
But the joke is, like, we have to all get new conspiracies because all our other conspiracy theories came true.
Yeah, right. So this is the thing, right? So, you know, I've said for years, going back to when Obama did this, I said, look, the only real reason they want economic regulation is they want to control content. Otherwise, what's the point of this?
Like
there's some actual economic problem they're trying to solve. So I said, there's got to be what this is about. And then I say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. But then what do we see during COVID, all right? What do we see? They were routinely calling companies and saying, you know, don't let this dangerous misinformation span. You have to do something about this, that, the other thing, election disinformation, climate denial. Basically, anything you say that they really don't like, they say, oh, this is dangerous. You need to, quote, unquote, voluntarily remove it. And, you know, though most of these companies are kind of liberal to start with, so they probably would be inclined to listen to this stuff. But imagine... now you know that the guy who's calling you and saying, hey, take a look at maybe, quote, voluntarily shutting up these conservatives. Now you know that agency's got total economic control over your business. They can decide whether your business model is allowed to exist, how much you're allowed to charge, whether you get smacked with, disparate impact discrimination claims, et cetera, et cetera. You're never going to say no to them, are you? And so I think that's exactly what this is about. It's about getting companies under the thumb of federal regulators so that they can suggest removing, quote, dangerous disinformation, which means shutting us up.
Yeah, which means we all go back into the heretic box again, and the witch burnings will continue. Wow.
If these regulations that they're proposing, I know they're kind of appealing a lot of this, and it isn't going to happen right away. But when would it take effect, do you think?
That's a really good question. I think the digital discrimination order, which was just the final, was published in the Federal Register last week. I think that one takes effect immediately. The net neutrality one, I'm not sure if that carries an effective date on it or not. I'd have to look that up.
And the discrimination order, what would that...
prepared for what's kind of an obvious question.
Yeah, what would the discrimination order, how would that impact what we're currently seeing?
Well, it means that, for the first time ever, the Federal Communications Commission is going to serve as sort of the equity police for the Internet, meaning people can say, someone can file a complaint that says, such and such company only hired white people to dig trench for a new fiber optic line or whatever, that means they were discriminatory or, whatever it might have been. And actually, it could be much, much more subtle than that. It could be, the price of whatever package is too expensive for a certain minority group or whatever it is, even though they charge the same price for everyone. It has a disparate impact on this group, and therefore it's discriminatory. Because the way they wrote the rule, it's not equal treatment, they're not trying to prohibit discriminatory action. They're trying to prohibit any action that has a disparate impact on a protected group. And so companies can be whacked with complaints and never intended to do anything wrong to anyone. And so it's going to be a very open-ended liability, and it's hard to predict exactly where it's going to go, but it's for the first time, I think, going to create a lot of potential exposure for companies. And then, the other aspect of it is they're going to have the equivalent of old-fashioned rate cases, like a utility regulator. If somebody comes in and says, the price they charged in this neighborhood was too high and it was discriminatory in its effect because people couldn't afford it, they're going to have to, build a record and decide what the rate should be. And so it becomes sort of a backdoor way to utility-style rate regulation as well.
Hmm. So it's all going to be pretty much up to the federal government's interpretation of what they're seeing, and that will push them forward.
It's pretty amazing. It's actually the digital discrimination one is kind of like a classic example of Republicans being kind of stupid. I mean, the when they were doing the bipartisan infrastructure law, they put $65 billion in there for broadband subsidies. And Republicans love this because they've got lots of rural areas and they think they're going to get all this money. Of course, I think given the bent of the Biden administration, tons of this money is going to go to urban areas that already have service anyway, and it's going to be all kinds of, the usual boondoggles. But the Republicans, they saw this money and said, oh, great, this is wonderful, we're going to support this. And the Democrats said, well, we just want some language in here that, we're going to prohibit digital discrimination. And the Republicans said, oh, okay, yeah, no, nobody's discriminating, so that's fine, no problem. And they put language, the way it was actually written, it was like equal access, it was language that a normal person would read and say they're just talking about intentional discrimination. Mm-hmm. But, of course, anytime you give new language to a left-wing regulatory agency, they're going to twist it and push the limits and do what they want to do with it. And so this Biden FCC said, we found zero evidence of any intentional discrimination. But instead of saying, and that means we don't need to regulate, they said, and therefore we're going to do this disparate impact standard and, open the door to any kind of complaint about anything. And now all the Republicans have voted for it. Oh, that's not what we meant. This is horrible. And it's like, okay, well, like, next time don't give any new authority, period. And you won't be in this situation.
I know it. See, that's the thing. Anytime you give them an inch, they're going to take a mile. They always do. They always go too far. And
yeah,
this is what you end up with.
Well, when you get into the whole broadband thing, the rural areas do need it, but what happens in a lot of those cases is they run the fiber optic line, from Mexico to Canada, but it doesn't go to anybody's house. Like, it does, you'd be blown away. Like, a lot of these programs, they run it through, like, a town or an area or whatever, but it doesn't actually go to the house. So if you live
I remember when Obama said,
gotta pay $2,000 to get it to your house from the street.
I remember when Obama said we're going to reach these last remote locations that don't have broadband, and I think he asked for $9 billion to do that, and it seemed like a lot of money at the time. And, now we've had, they did the $350 billion of state aid under COVID, and they said one of the things you should use it for is broadband, and they did another $65 billion in infrastructure. And, I don't know where all the money's going, but it's not going to reaching the very small percentage of the population that's still not connected. And, of course, when government runs these things, it becomes very corrupt and politicized, and it goes to, being subsidizing the third provider in some town somewhere that, is politically advantageous instead of actually reaching people who don't have a provider. And, we've just had enormous waste in all of these programs. And there's also insane politicization. So one of the subsidy programs...
Hold that thought, because let's do that all as one thing. We have to take a really quick break, and then we'll come right back. Our guest is Phil Karpin, and we are talking about the FCC regulations. His article is "More Debt Without Spending Reform is Dirty." And we have that posted for you today. It's January 28, 2024. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
What is the question? Resist the advances of force and aggression, and leave to your children the promise of something more. As God is my witness, I'll be a slave no
Hey.
I like that part. Let me hold your crown. Before I forget, the other article that's on there is about the topic we're discussing today. They're both really good, though. FCC's chair chairs bad Wi-Fi is not a reason to regulate the internet. I hope you go on and read that.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to where the money's going, Phil. Before I unceremoniously cut you off, sorry.
Oh, yeah. So this is, I think, an amazing example of why discouraging private investment and just saying, oh, we're going to make up for it with more taxpayer dollars is so destructive. Besides it being bad economics, it opens the door to political mischief and retribution on political grounds. And, you know, one of these subsidy programs is a program run at the FCC called the RDOF program. And they already had approved $900 million in subsidies for customers in sort of remote rural locations to SpaceX, Starlink Internet Service, which is Elon Musk's satellite Internet service. And the $900 million was to serve remote homes where it doesn't make sense to run wires because they're in the middle of nowhere at the top of a mountain or whatever it is. And the subsidy amount that they were going to serve these homes with for a subsidy of $1,000 per location on average for the $900 million grant that had already been approved. And then something went out, you know, after he had bought X and become a critic of the administration and whatever, and some kind of word went out from the White House, we think. And what do you know, they announced 3-2, actually, I don't even think they voted on it. I think the chairwoman did it herself. They said they were going to revoke the subsidy eligibility for Starlink, and it was no longer eligible, and they would not get the money they'd already been awarded, and they were going to re-award subsidies for the same households that were supposed to be served for a $1,000 subsidy by Starlink. They're now going to be served by other providers for an average $5,000 subsidy. And so in order to stick it to Elon Musk, we're going to spend five times more as taxpayers through this program. And maybe there's a good reason, although I can't imagine what it would be, but it looks for all the world like they're just, you know, taking revenge on a political rival of the president and doing it at very large expense to taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a pretty good example of the kind of mischief that occurs when you replace, you know, sort of a market-based approach to broadband with a, you know, taxpayer-funded, subsidy-heavy approach.
Yeah, and it also kind of demonstrates what you can do when you have basically unlimited resources to spend wherever you deem fit. And
by the way, it's not their money.
Yeah, exactly. It's not their money, and they're gonna award people that that they agree with. And it's I don't know. I think stories like that need to be screamed a little louder because it happens all the time.
Yeah.
You have picking the winners and the losers, and our government should not be involved in that.
Well, it's weird because they get, you know, the Department of Defense is still using Starlink, and so it's like, you know, it's good enough for a huge contract for the Defense Department, but it's not good enough for rural broadband. I don't.
Yeah.
It's the government's not even consistent with itself. It's so big, but yeah.
And where does that tie into some of this regulatory stuff? Does it keep the door shut on things like that, or is that a whole separate deal?
Well, I mean, it's not directly related, but as I was saying, you know, if you pile regulations on, you're going to get less investment from private companies, and I think you're also probably going to get less participation by private companies in some of these subsidy programs. And so what you're going to get is in some areas, you're going to get, you know, government-run networks. They're going to fill in because no commercial provider wants to be involved, and then you're going to end up paying for it, you know, with your state and your local and your federal tax dollars or in your electric bill or something like that. Or you're going to have, you're going to have a commercial provider but not one of the major ones without the same economies of scale, without necessarily the same quality of service and so forth. And so I think we're going down a path where, as a policy matter, as a choice, as a country, we're reversing one of the greatest policy decisions that was ever made, which was not to regulate the internet, not to mess with it, not to tax it, just to sort of leave it alone and see what happens. It's pretty unusual restraint from our federal government back in the 90s, actually, when Bill Clinton was president. It was Bill Kennard at the FCC who kind of said, you know, we're not going to use old-fashioned regulations for this new technology. We're going to kind of leave it alone and see what happens. And then the Powell FCC under Bush said the same thing for cable modem. And as a result, we had this competition between phone and cable in this country that made us kind of the world leader in terms of broadband. And, you know, the vast majority of people have at least two choices from the phone and cable company, and they compete with each other on price and on quality, and it's driven a lot of investment and a lot of improvement in technology. And if you start to say, you know what, we're going to have heavy government regulation that's going to deter private investment, and we're going to make up for it with subsidies, and government's going to be making the decisions, you know, we're not going to have, we're going to replace what worked really well with something that's not going to work as well, in my judgment. And I don't want to say it's going to be like the end of the universe and the internet's going to break down completely, because I don't want to be like the left, you know, making their over-the-top predictions. But I do think that, you know, on net we're going to get a worse experience, and we're going to pay more for it, even if, you know, even if our bill's a little less, we're going to pay more for it because of all the tax dollars we're going to be pouring in.
So with with a new administration that thinks a little differently, I mean, these regulations could be turned around and rolled back and changed.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Trump FCC repealed them last time. You know, they could repeal them again and probably will and should. But I think there's something pretty wrong with kind of our system overall, when every agency has these all these insane expensive regulations, and they sort of toggle on and off depending on the party in the White House. You know,
right.
we're supposed to have stable laws that go through the process of, you know, House and Senate and signed by the president or a veto override. We're not supposed to just have sort of vast power residing in all these agencies. And so, you know, and one of the challenges, I think, is, you know, it's great, we can turn this off. We can turn off a bunch of EPA regulations. Other, you know, every agency's got a bunch of expensive regulations. We can turn them off in a Republican administration. But can companies really make investments and make business decisions based on the repeal of regulations that they can sort of expect are going to be flipped back on the next time Democrats win? And, of course, you know, we saw this really with what happened with the auto industry, right? You know, Obama had all these auto regulations on fuel economy and sort of pushing things in the direction of electric cars, and Trump repealed them all. But what did the auto companies all say? They said, well, you know, we can't really change our strategy based on, you know, an administration that might only be 4 years. And they were probably actually smart to do that, because Biden put all the rules on, back on, and then some.
Right.
And so, you know, I wonder, if Trump comes in and repeals them again, are they going to actually change their plans? I mean, I don't know. So I wish the major economic questions were actually answered through our constitutional process, instead of it all being this, you know, these agency decision making.
Well, I was kind of maintained that the smart money would be for the legislative branch to sue the executive branch for overreach, for basically making.
Yeah, do the courts? I don't know if the courts want to be the arbiter.
Right,
of that.
Right.
I
mean, so then
for Congress to pass, right, you know, to take its powers back. I mean, it's delegated all of its. It passes these broad, vague laws, and then it sort of puts up token. You know, it.
Yeah.
Well, we tried our best to overturn whatever this agency did, but the president vetoed us. Nothing we can do. And it's kind of like, guys, you control the power of the purse. You control the power to rewrite all of those laws. You know, one of the bills that I've been working on for many years that would probably do the most to solve this state of affairs is a bill called the RAINS Act.
Yes.
It would actually prohibit any economically significant new regulation from taking effect unless it got sent up to Congress for a vote of approval first.
Yep.
If we could pass something like that,
that would be super smart.
You know, look, yeah, we still have a lot of dumb regulations because we know Congress is capable of doing lots of dumb things. But, you know, at least it wouldn't flip back and forth all the time with administrations. And at least when you got something dumb, you could look up who voted for it and hold them accountable come election time, instead of it all riding on the presidential. And so that's probably the most important kind of reform idea. And we have passed it in the House, you know, maybe five or six times. We've never been able to get a Senate vote. So we're going to keep chipping away on that. And, you know, the Supreme Court just heard a case that could potentially overturn the Chevron Doctrine, which is the decision from 1984 that tells courts that they should defer to the expertise of regulatory agencies unless it's arbitrary and capricious. And, of course, in practice, that means that regulatory agencies can do almost anything they want, and lower courts will not stop them. Sometimes the Supreme Court does, but lower courts will almost never stop them because they'll say, oh, we defer under Chevron. So if that case gets overturned, that could stop some of this. But I really think, you know, until voters start to say we can't have the whole kind of economic, you know, we can't have trillions of dollars of regulations riding on the presidential election every time, we've got to actually make Congress do its job and, you know, start punishing congressmen for not stepping up and taking their power back. You know, it's not going to change. As long as we tolerate it, it's not going to change. And so, I mean, that's kind of been our probably our number one long-term priority at American Commitment. And we've been working on kind of that broader structural issue for many years.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because we just, you know, when things are, when our decisions are made by executive order, then every 4 years, potentially every, you know, or eight, there's this massive whiplash that happens, and real laws that go through Congress take a long time to put in and take out.
It's not just that it whiplashes back and forth, but also, you know, it never quite whiplashes all the way.
No, you're right.
Oh, it never goes back all the way.
No, it's not an even whiplash, but it's just like people, people kind of go, wait, when did that happen? Because it doesn't go through the process. So they were...
Because we never quite get control over most of these agencies, even when we have the agency heads. It's very hard for them to actually control their own employees.
Right. And so people don't have any way to intercede in that. Yes, there's comment periods and all that, but they kind of go, yeah, okay, shut up, little people. You know, if you just let us run everything, the world would be so much better. Because I think that's what they think.
They really do. They do. They absolutely think that. You know, we actually, there was a survey recently that another group that I do work with called Committee to Unleash Prosperity did with Scott Rasmussen, and... He identified kind of who the elites are in our society. He developed sort of a rubric for that. I think it was income over $150,000 and lived in a high population density area and had a postgraduate degree, some kind of combination kind of like that. And then he surveyed that group of elites and their views compared to sort of voters in general. And it was pretty remarkable. I mean, the elites think that we have too much freedom in this country. Mm-hmm. They think we need less freedom and more government control. The elites think that we should ban internal combustion vehicles, that we should ban gas stoves, that we should ban privately owned air conditioning, that we should ban non-essential air travel, and I'm sure they think theirs is essential. But... you know, they've got views that are sort of alien to the rest of us on so many issues, and you know, those are their sincere beliefs, right? So they really do think that sort of the regulatory tyranny is being exercised for our own benefit. And there's the famous H.L. Mencken quote about how, you know, the worst tyrant of all is the omnipotent moral busybody who thinks that they're imposing their tyranny for your own benefit because they, you know, they have no remorse. I don't remember the exact quote, but you've probably seen it before. And I think that that's kind of what the left has become in this country. They think that the elite left, you know, the university professors and the media elites and the Wall Street chieftains and so forth, they really think that we don't know how to educate our own kids and take care of our own families and our own businesses, and that if they make these decisions for us, we'll be better off. And so they have no reason to ease up on any of this. They really think they think they're. Yeah, we're too dumb to make our own decisions, so they're going to help us out by making them for us.
Yeah, there really needs to be more pushback on that because we're seeing that in so many different areas. You're going to love this. It's going to be good for you.
Sit down, all you little people.
Yeah, sit down and just go
along
with
this. You're not qualified.
You'll see.
It's there's a really good book out there. It's about technocracy, and that's what the movement of technocracy. It wasn't about technology necessarily, but it was about the technocrats, so the bureaucrats, the people that were the experts. They believed that if they ran the whole world, that, you know, they ran everything and they could tell us all what to do. Stop electing dummies dummies electing dummies is bad. Let's get the experts in here and let them run everything. And, well, we saw how that worked out with COVID, and that was amazing.
I was about to say, we just ran that experiment on a global scale.
It was so awesome. God, yeah. It was so awesome while that was happening. I'm like, God bless America. This is that stinking technocracy thing. But it's like the dry run. And I thought, wow, you had Fauci and Burke and all these people. I thought, just in case anybody was curious how that turns out. Like, spoiler alert. We're still paying for that. We have to take one more quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Phil Kirpin. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Too slow.
Freedom, what did you hope to learn about here? If I was someone else, would this all fall apart? Strange, where were you when we started this game? I wish the real world would just stop hassling me.
Except for the fact that Bobby Brown was a really bad man. That was kind of a great song. I think, Phil, you should do American Commitment, the musical. Maybe use that as, like, your theme song. I can do what I want to do.
Yeah, it's my prerogative.
Good choice of songs, although, yes, you're correct. Probably not the spokesman we want.
Yeah, he was a horrible human being, but, you know, it was kind of a snazzy song, so it was like, I'm always torn. But, yeah, it's like, leave us the heck alone, but the technocrats and the bureaucrats, it's very interesting to me that when people go to work in Washington, D.C., they're, it's odd. Like, people think, oh, well, they go there and they drink Kool-Aid. Nah, I don't think so. I think it just exposes, like a flaw they already had, but what you really see is that they start to believe that they have all the answers, and that the people out in the cheap seats, that their input has no value. That seems to be the two teams that I've noticed. You have the guys that think they know everything, and then you have the other guys that are like, well, wait a minute, what about everybody else?
Right, and, you know, sort of to get back to where we started at the top, they're so convinced that they know everything that they will not be dissuaded by reality. You know, they will not be dissuaded by what's obvious right in front of their eyes. And so, you know, as I said, they brought back regulations that they were completely wrong about. I mean, they said if you deregulate, it's going to be the end of the world, dead bodies in the streets, it's going to be terrible, the internet will break completely. None of that happened. And now is their first opportunity. They're going to bring it back anyway. They're just going to pretend that whole insane, you know, apocalyptic, all of it, that never happened.
Well, I like the things that you list in your article. The end of the internet as we know it, headlined on the CNN homepage.
No, I mean, it's like ridiculous, right? Actually, the senior Republican on the commission, Brendan Carr, in his dissent from the dais, put up slides of, like, all these headlines and all these quotes. It was one of the funniest speeches I've ever seen. But, you know, they voted 3-2 anyway. You know, they weren't dissuaded by that. But it was pretty, you know, he did a pretty good job of shaming them to the extent he could. I mean, I don't know who watches those speeches other than me, but I thought it was good.
I think we pull out the ones we like. But, yeah, it's hard because that stuff's going on 24/7 on multiple channels. So,
yeah.
Little.
And to your point about COVID really being kind of like the ultimate, they had a chance to run everything in the whole world and they screwed all of it up catastrophically. You know, you and I know they screwed it all up catastrophically. They still think they did the right thing. It was, you know, it was the anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers and the disinformation. Otherwise, the lockdowns would have worked and been great. And, you know, they, as I said, they're impervious to reality. So it doesn't matter. I mean, there's a thing on the World Economic Forum website that says COVID-19 was the test of social responsibility. And then it says, like, what's next? And has all their climate stuff listed. It's not like a secret conspiracy. It's literally on their website. They say, okay, that was so great. That was the test. Now we're going to move on and do all this stuff on climate. And so it's not, they don't even know that they screwed everything up. They don't.
They don't know.
To their minds.
Well, look at the doctors who have had, you know, patients die. My doctor, our family physician, he's angry about it. He's like, I treated hundreds of people, and the only ones who died are the ones that got the shot. And he, you know, just there were obvious things that happened, and he's like, I cannot believe even medical professionals in my own area can't see this. So it wasn't even just government.
Well, I think a lot of them see it, but they're terrified to buck the system because they're afraid they're going to lose their license if they speak up.
Yeah, what if they come after me or whatever?
Exactly. And that's still happening. It's still happening, even though, the evidence that's come out since then about some of the flaws in all of that vaccine stuff.
Look at how many people are still wearing a mask in their car by themselves.
Did they actually pass a law in California that you can lose your medical license for COVID disinformation or something like that?
They kind of tried to do that, and then
and they backed off it?
Yeah, because that was like, okay, well, who's going to be making that decision? Are they going to be physicians or bureaucrats or what?
But doctors did get called before the medical board for speaking against the vaccine and threatened with losing their license.
Yeah.
I mean, that's their livelihood.
And the problem is they have to treat their patients, and if you can't do it because you're not using... You know, like he said, it's like the first day of virology. Like, what the heck? Like, these things, we know how to treat these things. This isn't new. But yeah, you involve the government then as the big brother who's going to come in and tell everybody. And look at just the mask thing. You know, it says right on the box that it's not there to treat viruses. You know, can't prevent a virus. So here, quick, strap this on your face.
There were like a dozen studies that showed that masks don't work.
But that's literally a disclaimer on the box.
You know, the CDC actually did a review in May 2020 of all the existing science, and they said they don't work. And then they mandated them for everyone anyway. And they just put all these websites up saying they do work. It's like, okay, now.
Okay.
And I mean, that I don't think it's over. I think they're still... You know, Jones is in for the control.
You've got some places that are going to do it every winter forever.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to admit they were wrong. And so you've got some hospital systems now that are going to mandate masks every winter for the rest of the time. And it's... I don't even know what to say.
But well, yeah, because if you could figure it out, it's a little bit like being able to understand, you know, child molesters and serial killers. Like, if you can actually understand why they're doing it, you might be one. So I think like some of this, the fact that we can't figure it out is actually good. It's frustrating, but it's a good sign. It means we can't get it.
But a lot of them don't even follow their own rules. I mean. I got called for jury duty last week, and right on their call it says, you know, you must wear a mask when you, you know, come into the courthouse. And I'm like, I'm not wearing a mask. I walked in, nobody was wearing a mask. You know, and so, I mean, you send out confusing things like that, and you know, this is what you get. You get this hysteria that, oh, I got to wear a mask.
Well, and so let's translate that back to... You fill your article here, you know, if the FCC wants to regulate the internet in a much tighter fashion, and this is the same kind of mindset we're operating with, what could go wrong?
I can think of a few things. Right, exactly. Look, I mean, it's we now know for a fact that the Biden administration actively induced private social media companies to censor conservatives on COVID, on the election, on climate, and so forth. And the Supreme Court just heard a case a few weeks ago, Missouri v. Biden, on whether that's a First Amendment violation. And I don't know how they're going to decide that case, because it's a tricky thing, right? And up to now, when you had First Amendment violations, it was the government censoring someone, expressing their speech in some way. Now it's a little bit of a different question. Is the government asking a private company to censor speech a violation of the First Amendment? I think it is. But I don't know how the Supreme Court's going to come down on that. But I can tell you that whether it's unconstitutional or not, it's a huge problem. And if there's more economic control over more companies, then there are a lot more opportunities for them to, quote, suggest voluntary, quote, voluntary censorship activities, which, of course, will greatly harm conservatives on every issue. And by the way, we were mostly right about the things they were censoring us on. It's not even like they were, you know, most of the disinformation was actually correct information, as it turned out. And so it's a very, very dangerous path that we're going down. And I think, regardless of how that Supreme Court case turns out, I think we really need legislation that Jim Jordan has introduced. They would actually make individual government employees responsible if they direct private companies to censor speech and expression. They, at a minimum, they should be fired and fined. I think they should get jail time. I think it should be criminal. Because if there isn't individual government employee responsibility,
yes,
then even if the Supreme Court said it's a First Amendment violation, there's no reason for them to stop. They're not going to be, nothing's going to happen to them. And so I really think we've got to get after this problem of government employees using their power over private companies as a way to censor their political opponents.
I don't disagree. And if there is no, we all know this. I mean, we know this from raising kids and dogs. You know, if there are no consequences, guess what? You got bad kids and you got unruly dogs. Everybody knows you have to have consequences, or it just doesn't work. Things don't self-regulate. So if you have people out there with all this tremendous amount of power, and they go too far, nothing happens, Lois Lerner, then they just do it some more.
Yeah, Lois Lerner retired with full pension.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you followed the Chaz Littlejohn case. Is that name familiar to you?
Yeah, why? It's like a blast from
Chaz
the past,
Little
though.
Chaz Littlejohn was the IRS contractor working for Booz Allen Hamilton, who only got the job at Booz Allen Hamilton because he saw that as a way to get access to private IRS data. Then once he got the private IRS data, he stole the years and years of tax returns for 7,500 of the richest taxpayers in the country.
I remember
he
that.
He sent Donald Trump's returns to the New York Times. He sent the other 7,000-plus people's returns to ProPublica, and they timed it around politically advantageous times. So, I mean, this guy committed 7,500-plus felonies, and they pled him out to one count of a single charge of, and they haven't done the sentencing yet, but he's going to get a total slap on the wrist. One count for stealing, 10 years of returns from 7,000 people and sending them to the media.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
so I'm sure he has no regrets. I mean, he got away with it essentially.
Yeah, there are just a lot of examples of that kind of thing, and yet you have people who try to do the right thing. We had a government employee in our area who stood up for the people who were fighting fire here. We have lots of those, and stood up for them and stopped the they were feeding them like moldy bread and moldy, the food was unbelievable, and so she got rid of the contractor, the big government contractor that was running the food service, and had somebody else come in and provide food, and she's working in Siberia now because she did the right thing. And you think, wow, doesn't really pay to do the right thing in the bureaucracy. But if you do the wrong thing, there's no consequence. There only seems to be consequence for people who color outside the lines and go against their, go against the overlords. I don't know. It just seems bizarre. So, what can people do? Can people do anything with this FCC thing, or is this something we just have to watch?
Well, we've been sending them letters. The official comment deadline was the 18th, so if you sent it now, they would call it an ex parte. It wouldn't technically count, but
okay,
you can still write to them. And our form also is set up so that if you do write to them, it'll send a copy to your congressman and two senators as well, and you can bug them about it. And,
so they can go to AmericanCommitment.org?
Yep. That's
And that's where it's on there? Could you would you come back on and tell us about it? After,
To answer your earlier question about the effective date, we don't have that yet because this is still a proposed rule. When
okay.
they issue the final, which could be any day because the comment period is closed, now that will have the effective date. So I actually didn't know it because it doesn't exist yet.
Nice.
Okay, good.
All right, we have to run away. And we'll let you get on with your Sunday. Thanks for coming on with us. And
yeah, thanks, Phil.
We look forward to chatting with you again. That has been Phil Kirpin, the president of the American Commitment. You're listening to We the People. We'll have this posted for you at wethepeopleradio.us.